Welcome to The Break Breakdown, a podcast by Queensbird Films. I'm your host, Courtney Romano, and this is episode 30. I started this podcast 10 months ago at this point, at the time of this recording, to kind of demystify what it takes to get a film made. This podcast is a blend of the philosophical and the practical, you know, the heart and the head. One without the other is, in my mind, a half measure. So as I'm in pursuit of the full measure, this podcast brings together expert advice and stories from other artists in the film industry and beyond who have really, truly broken through. And then also brass tacks, kind of practical tips that you can use to actually get stuff done and accomplish things. And I looked up the word, the synonym for tips, because it sounded almost too expert-y to me and too advice-y to me. What I mean by sharing expert tips with you is just sharing my own process and opening up about what I'm doing and what I'm attempting to do. And also sharing my failures, what didn't work. I think that's an episode I'm going to do down the line, just all these failures that I've had this year, and share those. And then the things that did work for me, always under the caveat that you know best what's going to work for you. And this is all in the spirit of sharing and demystifying and creating a community around these kind of nebulous and elusive ideas of breakthrough and getting your big break. And if you've enjoyed this podcast so far, I would kindly ask you to please leave a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts. And if you've already done that, thank you so much. And please share this on social. If you take a quick screenshot and tag us at Queensbird Films, that would help to get the word out about the podcast. And to my earlier point, basically just helps us connect to the people who are listening. Because the idea is to create a community. The idea is to create a conversation around all of these things in our industry, in the film and theater and music and art industry, that are generally gatekept, information that's generally kept exclusive. And why? There's no reason to. There's no reason that we can't all help each other. And that's kind of my post-capitalist dream, that the power in our industries becomes decentralized, so that we value quality and innovation and novelty and community over quantity and cliches and commodification and rugged individualism that always somehow ends up with one person with, you know, $8 billion and another person who can't get healthcare. So that's my little dream. Okay, so today we are going to discuss the Fleur de Mal Guide to Pitching Your Work. So pitching is something that is really, talk about nebulous and elusive. No one really knows how to do it until they do it. And it's and the other thing about pitching is it's almost like whittling away what you shouldn't do versus what you should do. It's really difficult to create a blueprint for exactly how to pitch your work because everyone does it differently and it should be done differently. And there are a lot of different facets to pitching. So we're just going to cover this one general facet today. And if you want, I can go into more specifics in later episodes. So just let me know what you think on there. Shoot me a DM if there's a certain particular thing about pitching that you want me to cover. But this general concept I'm talking about today is the fleur de mal. That's French. And I'll explain it. In this episode, I'm going to explain what the fleur de mal is, what it has to do with pitching. And then I'm going to give you three questions at the end that you can ask yourself within this concept to improve your pitch. So by the end of this episode, you'll be able to sit down and use these questions to make your pitch magnetizing, which is the point, to draw people in, to hear what you have to say, and then they can decide whether or not it's for them, but to draw them in and magnetize them to your work in the first place. If you want to go deeper than just this one episode and these three questions, I also made a guide in Notion that you can download for free. That link is in the show notes. And also, I just want to shout out to Michelle Pelzon from Holisticism and the 12th House podcast, who I feel like I talk about on every episode. But here I go again. Michelle is amazing, and she introduced me to Notion through her work with Holisticism. And Notion is free software that I use for organizing, for brainstorming. I give myself edit notes in there. It's really easy to see my edits on every script or episode scene. And anyway, I made this template in Notion. Even if you don't have a Notion account, it's free. But even if you don't have a Notion account, you can still access it and you can still see the web page. If you decide that you want to sign up for Notion, you can also duplicate the page that I made for you and put it in your Notion dashboard as a kind of workbook. So just throwing that out there, the link is in the show notes if you want to go deeper. And yeah, let's get into this. Okay, so recently I got entranced with this concept of the fleur de mal. It's French, and it means a morbid or scandalous creation in literature or art. So if you Google fleur de mal art, F-L-E-U-R-D-U-M-A-L, you'll find an abundance of seemingly disjunctive scenes. Mainly, I found representations of death, like skeletons, evil ghosts, things like that, and then life, flowers, nature, things springing to life or blooming. So the fleur de mal brings up this contradiction that when you look at the art, it almost feels grotesque. Like, why is the skeleton rising out of these flowers? Why is it so beautiful? Like, when it's also stirring in me something uneasy, like almost like it's forcing me to look at death as much as I'd prefer to look at life. And the more I thought about this whole concept of the fleur de mal, and when I see it in art, what it brings up in me, I thought anything that operates within the fleur de mal concept, you know, in therapy, they call it both and. In modern day self-help, they might say holding two truths at once. Anything that operates within that concept is always an attention grabber, is always magnetic. Because we simultaneously know it's true, we may not want it to be true, and we can't look away. Anything that has this kind of, you know, when I'm looking at the skeletons and the flowers and this kind of dichotomy of images coming together, I there's something about it that pulls me in that's true. There's something about it that scares me, and there's something that hooks me. So it's like, it's the thing we know about life often but don't say out loud to ourselves as we're just going about our day, which is that, you know, life is absolutely stunning and also cruel and mainly absurd. It's all of these things. And the fleur de mal holds all of that. Some qualities that I just listed out of the fleur de mal could be, and this could be qualities that you find in art, right? So I think art is a really easy example because you can look at an image and get an immediate reaction from it. So some qualities that this kind of work could elicit or have is the work is irresistible. It's unashamed. It doesn't ask permission. It can be grotesque. It can be confrontational. At the same time, it can be sacred. Unabridged, vital, exhilarating. Some pieces of art that are beyond just actual visual art and painting and all of that, that have this fleur de mal energy, I thought was, one example was David Mamet's Oleana, because there was so much controversy when it was first off Broadway in the early 90s, because it was essentially a he said, she said play that talked about sexual harassment and power and education. And it stirred a lot in people, a lot of things that people felt like, hey, like, you can't go there with this, or, you know, this is very provocative. And I mean, it's been brought back to Broadway. It's been done all over the country. It was a success because whether you loved it or hated it, it was magnetizing because you loved it or hated it. Another more contemporary piece of fleur de mal, of art that I think has a fleur de mal energy is This Is America by Childish Gambino. So that came out in 2018, and it was this stark and also satirical portrayal of race and violence in America. And people went nuts in both directions. Like people were like pulling their hair out in good ways about it and like angry about it. Because in that, especially in the music video that he created with it, because there was something about it that we knew was so true and we didn't want it to be true and we couldn't look away from it. So that is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the fleur de mal, those two examples. But it's not just in art, it is actually everywhere in our lives. One really kind of tangible example of how it showed up in my own life is my C-section scar. So after I gave birth, I had had an emergency C-section, and maybe, you know, my daughter was born at 12 in the morning, so it was probably like 10 a.m. The doctor comes in and says, "Oh, Courtney, how you doing? Okay, yeah." And I just really wanted to say, "I'm so sorry for the way that your scar looks. It's not usually supposed to be like that, and I'm so sorry." And I hadn't even looked at my wound yet, at my scar, because I was like a new mom and my body was coming out of like this intense period of time and hormones were like leaving my body at rapid paces. Like, I hadn't even thought to look yet. And she told me that, and I couldn't, and she left the room and I just started sobbing because I was like, I can't even look at it. And then I looked at it. Anyway, my point with this is, with that scar, because of the way everything happened, it took almost 10 weeks for me to actually fully, like, for the actual wound to heal and start really scarring over. So for 10 weeks, I was living in this kind of grotesque space with it. Like, I just hated it. She had framed it in a way that was, like, super negative to me, and I kind of took that in. I wasn't really at a point where I could guard my energy and my thought process too much, so I'd really, really inculcated what she had said. It was grotesque. It was really difficult to manage and maintain. Everything hurt. And now it is my favorite thing about my body for a multitude of reasons that you can probably, you know, that probably sound cliche, so I don't really want to say them out loud, but it's my favorite thing about my entire body. I couldn't bear to look at it at first. I couldn't even look at it. Now it's my favorite thing about myself. And there is something about my C-section scar that is undeniable, magnetizing. When I look at it, I see everything. So that is the fleur de mal energy that I'm talking about. It is, I am hooked on it. I think it's beautiful. I think it's grotesque. I think it is encompassing all of life. In art, we know it. In life, we know it. That is fleur de mal. So what does that have to do with pitching? All right, what does the concept of the fleur de mal have to do with pitching? So to back it up, for our latest project that is a digital series, we've been gearing up to start pitching this web series in a round of fundraising, public grants and private donations. The process has been, so far, a lot of editing the pitch deck itself, what needs to be in it, what doesn't need to be in it. And then this is, and what we kind of call out of the pitch deck is also largely based on what I can present through myself in a meeting that doesn't need to be written down or visually seen. What can I express myself? So, you know, there are lots of ways to do a pitch deck. There's no right way. It really depends on your project. It's like, how can you visually express your project? And that is going to be different for every person, every project, every team. Sometimes it might depend on who you're actually pitching to, what the actual visuals look like. But let's just say for now, for this conversation, that you have your pitch deck where you want it to be. You like it. It feels expressive. It's not giving away everything, but it's as close a visual representation as you can get to the ideas and themes behind what you're making. And it gives the people on the other side of the table an idea of how everything's going to visually come together. Okay, great, done. You have the pitch deck. Now the hard part, what to say and how to express this fleur de mal concept when we go into meetings, into pitch meetings. So my dear friend and creative consultant who is coaching me gave me this $1 million piece of advice, which I'm going to share with you right now, and then we're going to keep connecting the dots back to fleur de mal. He said, no one is going to care about this story more than you do. What they do care about is you. So when you walk into a pitch meeting, when we're going in there, people are not there for our concept. The concept almost has to be a given. Like, of course it's good, of course it's cohesive, of course it's together. That's a baseline of competence, I would say. But what they're really there to find out about is you. Because you are the catalyst behind the work. You're the imagination. You're the engine that's going to keep the train moving, keep the costs down, keep the timeline kept. You're the one who's going to attract people to your team. You're the one they're investing in or donating to or supporting. If you believe in what you're making and if you've fully realized your idea and can 100,000,000% believe in it when you walk into a room, then all you have to get them on board with is you. So how do you get them on board with you? This is where the Fleur de Mal comes into play. So if we look back at some of the qualities of the Fleur de Mal, the irresistibility, vitality, exhilaration, these are the exact qualities that would elicit someone to say yes to your idea. But remember, they're not saying yes to your idea, they're saying yes to you, right? So we have to use the concept of the Fleur de Mal on ourselves first. What this means is going into dark places, the ugly, the grotesque, the exhilarating midnight, as it were, of ourselves. Okay, we are going into the place that is magnetizing, where we cannot look away, where we cannot avert our eyes because we just have to see what's there. That place is what we're trying to connect to when we're in a pitch meeting. Because, you know, the person on the other side may say yes, may say no, but to be able to give you a true answer, an answer that's going to move the ball forward, whether they're on board or not, they need to be connected to that magnetic place. So how do you draw them in? Okay, so I have three questions based on this Fleur de Mal concept that are meant to improve my pitch. These are questions that I have been sitting with for weeks. So I whittled them down and kind of outlined them for you so you could just take it. This is something I probably shouldn't say weeks. It's been months that I've been chewing on these questions and kind of living in these questions. So here are the three questions. One, what is my fear keeping me from? As in, what would I experience if fear was removed for a second? This is not the same question, I want to be clear, as what would I go after if I knew it was possible? No, 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 no. That's not this question. That is something else. In these exact circumstances that you're in right now, exactly how everything is without changing anything on the outside, you know, maybe you have a meeting, maybe you don't have the meeting yet, maybe you have the funding, maybe you don't. Wherever you are right now, whatever fear you have around that right now, if you muted the fear for a second, what is just underneath that? So whatever your answer is there is actually an underused tool. Maybe your answer, like if you just muted fear for a second, it doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't dissipate, it's just like, let me mute that and see what else is there. Maybe your answer is clarity. Maybe it's confidence. Maybe it's something like humor. Like you'd have more of a sense of humor about things. Whatever that tool is, you can use it even while you walk into that pitch room with fear, right? It's like that whole thing that Elizabeth Gilbert talked about where fear is riding in the back seat. It's not out of the car just because you have courage, right? Riding shotgun, or creativity, I think she said, riding shotgun. Fear's in the back seat. It's always coming along. We're not trying to deny that part. But what is, you know, if you see the skeleton, if fear is like the skeleton in the Fleur de Mal art, what is the flower that's trying to bloom right underneath it or is blooming underneath it? When you walk into the pitch room, you bring that tool with you, whatever your answer was, because if your fear is trying to suppress that underused tool, then you can be sure that that tool is super powerful and it's a gold mine. I don't know why. I don't know what it is for you. I kind of know what it is for me and I'm still exploring it. Again, I've been thinking about this for months. But if fear is trying to suppress it, then it's a powerful thing at your disposal. The second question that I ask myself is, what do I do to undermine myself? So this one is so easy. I'm like, where should I begin? I have so many great answers to this because I undermine myself all the time. First of all, I usually over-communicate. Second of all, I act like I know less than I do. Third, I self-deprecate to make sure everyone feels really, 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 really comfortable in my presence. And it's funny because recently, I was out on my porch with my daughter talking to a new neighbor who'd moved in, and she was asking me what I did. And I told her, and when I came back in, the window was open in our front room. When I came back in, Craig was like, "That was a really good pitch." And I said, "What? What do you mean? What? I didn't pitch?" He's like, "No, she asked what you did, and it was the clearest answer you'd ever given, and whatever that elevator pitch was about, you know, I think I was telling her about the film screen test that we had made and this thing that was coming up." He's like, "However you said that was so clear and concise and confident, like it was the best I had ever heard you." And this is because usually when I pitch to someone, there are so many qualifiers, just so many qualifiers. So when you ask yourself, what do I do to undermine myself? What you're really doing is noting the landmines before they happen. So when you walk into the room, you know, whatever your answer was to that question, when it comes up, you note it. Realize you're going to want to do it when you're pitching. You're going to want to make yourself feel more comfortable. You're going to want to do the thing that is burnt into your neural pathway to continue doing because you've always done it and it's just a natural reflex and I'm nervous and so I rely on my reflexes. Instead, every time you feel that undermining thing come up, literally give yourself a 10-second pause before you say anything. Like, slow it down. Take it back before you say, "What do I know? I've only made, you know, one film before." Just don't say it. Just don't say it, because that thing that's undermining you is, again, just kind of blocking you from what is really trying to show up. And that uncomfortable space is, again, very magnetizing. It's hard to look away from. I mean, if you've ever seen someone, I'm not telling you to go into a pitch meeting and stumble on all your words. I'm not saying that at all. But if you've ever seen someone kind of stumble through, it's like you're almost, like a presentation, it's almost like you're hanging on their every word because you're like, are they going to get it out? And really what I'm trying to say is, if you give yourself just a couple seconds of a break between doing that undermining behavior and moving forward in your pitch, you almost secondarily create this fascinating energy. It's like when people stop saying or like. I say like all the time. And when people stop saying that, you hang on their every word more. The third question that I ask is, what am I afraid I'll never get a chance to say? So, not to quote Hamilton, but I'm going to quote Hamilton. One of the lines that always got me was, why do you write like you're running out of time? Because even though we know how Hamilton ends and we know all this, I think it's so true for most people that we have this ultimate FOMO, akin to the question, will my life amount to anything? Placing this question, what am I afraid I'll never get a chance to say, in the context of fear is actually kind of useful because it heightens the stakes. And again, this is all stuff you're doing behind the scenes, right? It's you're doing this before you walk into the room. So you're safe. You can go here. You can let yourself explore this. You can dive in and wonder to yourself about this, or journal, or make a voice memo, or whatever. So when grants or investors say, you know, Courtney, why this story? Why is this important? I could always point to some beneficent reason, right? I could always say, well, it's going to help people, blah, 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 blah. But humans, much like the characters we write, always want something for their own stakes. What is that? What is that for me? What is that for you? For me, you know, what am I afraid I'll never get a chance to say? I'm actually afraid that I'll never get to make the broken beautiful. It's this thing, like the things that have broken in my heart are always the things that I write about. The places where I am most ashamed are always the things that I write about. And I want to make them beautiful. And I could go into a laundry list of why I want to do that, but you're not my therapist and this isn't really about me. So what is that for you? What are you afraid you'll never get the chance to say? If you can answer that question, then you can walk into the room and whatever that answer is, you can call it up. It can be potent. You know, either right before you get in or when you get stuck in a question in the conversation or you don't know exactly which way to go, you can channel that very potent desire. Why do you need to say this now? What are you afraid that you'll never get the chance to say if you don't just say it? And again, people may not have the same desire as you, but they're going to respond to that intensity of energy with which you are accessing it. And they're going to say, okay, I want to know more about that, whatever that is. That seems vibrant and vital and exciting and exhilarating and magnetic. What is that? It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to give you the chance, but it means they're going to be drawn in an inch closer. So just to recap those questions, number one was, what is my fear keeping me from? Number two was, what do I do to undermine myself? And number three was, what am I afraid I'll never get a chance to say? Okay, so that's the fleur de mal guide to pitching your work. You know, it's spicy, I'll tell you that. And here's the thing, if you want to Google PDFs of pitch decks, you can absolutely do that. I have Googled PDFs of pitch decks, and there's an array, and there are all sorts of templates. I never like any of them at all. They're either like too out there, or not out there enough, or like they're just not, I'm not compelled by them. So my advice if you wanted to build out your actual visual pitch deck is to get Canva, which is a great resource. You can do a lot of it for free. I pay for the monthly membership because you can do a lot more, and I use it for a bunch of things. But Canva is a great resource to get started and kind of putz around and see, you know, what visually you're pulled to. If you're not necessarily a graphic designer, which I am not, that's a brass tacks thing that you can actually, you know, physically in the physical realm do. And there's no right or wrong way. Like, this is all very arbitrary. What you need to do in the pitch deck is just find the way that best expresses the concept of your piece. To be able to do that, you got to get clear on what your piece is. But that's really all you have to do for a pitch deck. The other part of the pitch deck, though, as we've been saying, is how you walk into the room and what you present as yourself. If you want to be able to be magnetic when you pitch, there has to be a strong, vital energy churning. And this fleur de mal concept is one way of many ways to get there. And I happen to think that it's kind of a fun one because you get to look into the darkness and the midnight, as I called it, and make it a strategic midnight. Mine yourself for these kind of secret weapons or, you know, secret tools and strengths that you haven't given yourself a chance to explore yet, and then explore it in the pitch meeting. Okay, that's it. If you want to go deeper, the link is in the show notes for the free Fleur de Mal pitch guide. You can just go in there, drop in your email, and you'll get directed right to it. You don't have to wait for an email or anything. It'll just send you right to the link. And if you had any breakthroughs or ideas come up for you during this episode or while you're doing the guide, the little workbook, or you thought of other questions like I posited that helped your pitch, DM me. I would love to hear from you. Like I said, this is about all of us kind of coming together and working on this group project called Life together. All right, I'm going to go work more on my own pitch. I love you. Thank you for being here, and I'll talk to you soon.